From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I want to address the events of last night first and foremost.
That was White House spokesperson Sean Spicer on Tuesday opening his daily press conference with a reference to the resignation announced late Monday of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn.
We've been reviewing and evaluating this issue with respect to General Flynn on a daily basis for a few weeks, trying to ascertain the truth. We got to a point not based on a legal issue, but based on a trust issue, where the level of trust between the president and General Flynn had eroded to the point where he felt he had to make a change. The president was very concerned that General Flynn had misled the vice president and others. He was also very concerned in light of sensitive subjects dealt with by that position of national security advisors like China, North Korea, and the Middle East, that the president must have complete and unwavering trust for the person in that position. The evolving and eroding level of trust as a result of this situation and a series of other questionable instances is what led the president to ask for General Flynn's resignation. Immediately after, the Department of Justice notified the White House counsel of the situation. The White House counsel briefed the president and a small group of his senior advisors. The White House counsel reviewed and determined that there is not an illegal issue, but rather a trust issue. During this process, it's important to note that the president did not have his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, who he trusts immensely, approved by the Senate. When the president heard the information as presented by White House counsel, he instinctively thought that General Flynn did not do anything wrong, and the White House counsel's review corroborated that. It is not ordinary for an incoming national security advisor to speak with his counterparts about the issues of concern to them. In fact, he spoke with over 30 of his counterparts throughout the transition. As Charles Krauthammer said last night, it is, quote, perfectly reasonable for him to do so. The issue here was that the president got to the point where General Flynn's relationship misleading the vice president and others, or the possibility that he had forgotten critical details of this important conversation, had created a critical mass and an unsustainable situation.
Flynn has been accused by Democrats and the U.S. media of violating the Logan Act, a federal statute that prohibits private citizens from negotiating with foreign governments in the midst of a dispute with Washington. The alleged violation was a discussion by Flynn as a member of the Trump transition team with a diplomat of Moscow of U.S. sanctions against the Russian Federation. For more on that, we spoke with Dmitry Babich, senior editor at the Russian news agency Sputnik. We spoke with him via Skype Tuesday. So, Dmitry, a setback for the Trump administration and using Russia as the foil. How dare Flynn speak with a Russian ambassador looking towards chilling out the tensions that the Obama administration was jacking up on the way out?
Well, you are quite right. I tried to find a precedent in world history for this kind of attitude, and I can only remember Stalin arresting the wife of his aide, Vyacheslav Molotov, for having an unauthorized talk with the Israeli ambassador. But that was in the early 50s, I can't think of any other examples when someone would be declared almost a traitor to motherland for just speaking to a foreign ambassador without cutting any deals, but just pronouncing the word sanctions. So I think it just shows that Trump is not ready to resist. He is quickly losing the battle to the ultra-liberals in the White House and elsewhere. And these guys, I mean the ultra-liberals, they're showing us that they don't need to win elections to govern the United States. That they can govern via all these courts of appeals, Circuit 9. They can govern via their people in the Congress. They can govern via the media. They can remove people from the president's inner circle, including the national security advisor, because they talk to their own ambassador. So these guys are actually, they continue to rule despite losing the elections.
Yeah, and what's interesting is one of the points of the election. You know, one of the things that Trump promised to do was to try to reduce tensions with Russia, to, you know, work jointly with Russia in Syria. This was a campaign issue, and it was one that was a distinct position from that of Hillary Clinton. He was elected perhaps because of that. Some are saying despite that, but, you know, a lot of sane people think because of that. And the Obama administration rushes in the closing days to try to heighten tensions, throws out all the diplomats that they threw out, you know, things that really were unprecedented. And how dare the Trump administration attempt to do damage control before it takes office? It is pretty unprecedented.
Well, you're right. I think we can safely say that when people in the United States voted at the last election, I'm not even sure they voted for Trump. I'm sure they voted against Hillary Clinton, as the candidate of war. That was their intention. And what we see now is there is a person in Trump's inner circle who just tried to raise the issue of sanctions against Russia, which is basically moving towards more security, removing the only existential threat to the planet Earth that we have right now, and that is the existential threat of a war between the Western world and Russia with possible participation of China. And here we have him, disgraced, thrown out. It's quite clear that Trump was unable to defend him or was unwilling to defend him. That shows that Trump is actually a wimp. He is giving in to these people. He seems to have forgotten how dishonest they were, how they lied about him being a Russian puppet and using the Russian hackers to win the election. All of these terrible lies, which he knows were lies. So it's just amazing how he pretends to believe these ultra-liberals like right now. The way the media handled Flynn's resignation is just disgraceful. You know, I was interviewed today by Al Jazeera, and they just repeated all of this mind-boggling stuff, you know, like Flynn lied about his conversation with the Russian ambassador. He didn't tell his superiors immediately afterwards that the word sanctions was pronounced. Actually, what we see is a clear provocation. It is more or less obvious what happened. So the U.S. security services obviously record the conversations of the Russian diplomats. It would have been a scandal if it transpired that Russian security services record the conversation of the American ambassador in Moscow. Then it would be a big scandal in the United States. They would view it almost as a casus belli. But here, no one is even asking questions. Okay, we were listening to the phone of the Russian ambassador, and we were listening to the phone of the future national security advisor. So the U.S. security services recorded this conversation. They leaked this information to this very honest journalist, David Ignatius of the Washington Post, who used to come to Moscow and say he was basically a peace activist, you know, denouncing George Bush the Jr., coming to Moscow to show that there is not just George Bush the Jr. calling the shots in the United States. So this old liar published a nasty article in the Washington Post, basically reporting on Michael Flynn as being a foreign agent in the Joseph Stalin's like style. And all of the media just repeated this stuff, saying, how dare he talk to the Russian ambassador? Well, I, as a journalist, I used to talk to the American ambassadors in Moscow, and it was not viewed as a treason. Now they say, how could he talk to the Russian ambassador? He was still a private citizen. Okay, I talk to the American ambassadors here as a private citizen. No one, neither Mr. Putin nor the FSB, never asked me any questions about that. And that's normal. Obviously, that's normal in any democratic country. Unfortunately, that obviously doesn't apply to the United States now.
You know, what's interesting is the fact that, in fact, he may have legally been a private citizen at that point in time, but he was a part of the transition team for the new administration. That Trump was getting trashed wall to wall in the media that he wasn't meeting with the national security advisor of Obama and the intelligence operatives of Obama's frequently enough that he apparently didn't care enough to pay attention to get brought up to speed or whatever. But where it appears that he was actually trying to get, you know, ahead of the curve, knowing that you have this existential threat facing your administration that's coming in a few weeks, and it's treated like treason. It's exactly the word that, that people were using here.
Well, I mean, it was obvious that the ultra-liberals, the warmongers as they are, they will do everything possible to attack Michael Flynn. They made a nasty campaign out of his visit to Moscow in 2015. He came to a conference organized by RT, and that was enough for the people like Anne Applebaum to start a real, real Stalin-like campaign against him. Like, he came to the capital of a hostile nation. He sat three chairs away from the president of the Russian Federation. So what? You know, there are dozens of Russian journalists, military people, politicians who visit the United States. Sometimes they sit next to Obama. Sometimes they sat next to George Bush, the junior. No one here said that they were traitors and they need to be treated somehow differently from other citizens. Even though these people very often, the so-called Russian liberals, they come to the United States asking for more sanctions against their own country.
Right.
This is reported in the Russian liberal press. What is interesting is that the Russian patriotic press does not report it because Russians and the Russian elite want good relations with the United States, so they prefer not to concentrate on this. But the Russian liberal press reports it as kind of courageous actions. You know, this Vladimir Karamurza, you know, he had some stomach problems recently, and all of the Western press said he was poisoned by the Russian state. Right. He came several times to the EU and to the United States asking for more sanctions to be imposed on his own country. The sanctions are, of course, are idiotic. If Michael Flynn had given himself more time to think about it, he would understand that these sanctions actually served the opposite of the purposes that Obama set himself. I mean, these sanctions, they hit the rich people in Russia, the bankers. But, you know, the idiotic American elite and the idiotic American mainstream press, they believe that the rich people in Russia are anti-American, that they are all FSB generals, you know, making money on Crimea. That is baloney, my friends. The rich people in Russia are very pro-American, pro-Obama, pro-Clinton, and the sanctions hit them. These people can no longer borrow money at a lower interest rate from the U.S. banks and then lend this money to the Russian industry at a higher percent, at a higher interest rate. That's how they made their money for decades. And that was a game between the guys like Mr. Soros and his buddies in Moscow. So they were that way ripping off the people in Russia and in other countries. Now that system was stopped by Mr. Obama, who obviously thought that he hit the FSB generals. No, he hit the pro-American bankers. That's what happened. So it was not Obama's good intentions that led to the positive effect of sanctions on the Russian economy. It was his stupidity and his lack of professionalism, the lack of professionalism of the team, of his team. Still, morally, it was creating a bad atmosphere. Everyone was talking about sanctions against Russia. So Mr. Flynn was basically destroyed for merely trying to improve the atmosphere in the relations between Russia and the United States. That's a disgrace. And unfortunately, it destroys a lot of hope associated with Trump. Because, as I said during our last conversation, there is only one way how Trump can survive politically. That is to look Gorgona in the eye, Gorgona being the ultra-liberal awful ideology, to say that I'm not fighting two bad journalists from CNN and from the Washington Post. I'm not fighting the so-called media These media is bought and sold. What is important is the ideology behind this media. So I'm fighting this terrible, cruel ideology that destroyed Iraq, that destroyed Libya, that destroyed Syria, that destroyed Ukraine, that seeks to destroy Russia and China. I'm fighting them, and I call on you, honest people from all the earth, including Russia and China, help me to fight them. That is the only way he can survive politically. If he thinks that he can survive giving up Flynn, giving up his other candidates for various jobs, if he thinks that these guys, the ultra-liberals, would just forget about him and things would settle themselves, if he thinks so, he will lose. Because that's exactly what the ousted Ukrainian president Yanukovych thought. He was not anti-Western. He wanted to be friends with the United States and with the EU. He did everything to please them. He gave them a lot of privileges and money. That did not prevent them from supporting the nastiest Nazis in an open coup against him. You know, they toppled him despite him being pro-Western. So the same technology may be used against Mr. Trump, but if he thinks that by sacrificing the honest people like Michael Flynn, he will survive politically, he is dead wrong, as George Bush the senior used to say.
You know, I don't know how widely known the law that was being invoked, the piece of American legislation that was being invoked as with the claim that Flynn had violated it. I don't know how familiar people are with it, but the history of it, in fact, is that an American private citizen headed off a war that was underway called the Quasi-War with France at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. He went over. At the time, the United States had decided to renege on the debt that it owed to France, that France had helped finance the Revolutionary War. They were making payments. Suddenly, they made friends with Great Britain. Great Britain said, stop paying France. So they stopped paying France. France started capturing American seamen, and there were open hostilities with the U.S. Navy and the French Navy capturing, seamen from each other's countries and imprisoning them. He went over. He explained the political climate in the United States, including a media campaign against France, and suggested releasing the American prisoners. They did. It deflated the situation. There was peace reached. And when he came home, because the media gave him credit for it instead of the politicians, in particular President John Adams, this law was passed. And that was the history of it. This man who made peace between the U.S. and France ended up as the sponsor or as the cause for a law outlawing that behavior in the future. I assume that that's not widely known among the population in Russia, but what is the response of the media there in looking at this? What do they see when they see this?
Well, interestingly, there was not much of a reaction during the whole day. You know, the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said it was an internal affair of the United States. A few political leaders, you know, like the former heads of various Duma and Senate foreign committees, people like Konstantin Kosachev and Alexei Pushkov, they spoke out. They spoke out in the same vein that I just described, that this is McCarthyism. This is obviously terrible when a person is destroyed politically and personally simply for talking to the Russian ambassador. But the reason why the reaction from the Kremlin is muted, I think, is just because the Russian administration, I'm afraid, also is making the same mistake as Trump has made and as Yanukovych has made. They think that they can negotiate with the ultra-liberals, that the ultra-liberals are after U.S. interests, after all. So if we do something in a way that would be profitable for the United States, they would understand and leave us in peace. Nope. That's not going to happen. That's like expecting Leo Trotsky to forget about the World Revolution. Leo Trotsky might forget about his children destroyed one by one by Stalin, but he would never, never, never forget about the World Revolution. In the same way, the ultra-liberals, you know, they signed their death warrant on Trump, they signed their death warrant on Putin. These death warrants are insane. Trump and Putin are not enemies of humanity, but that means nothing to the ultra-liberals. When they pronounce a certain political leader their enemy, that means they're going to use against him all possible methods, including death. You know, we have seen it with Gaddafi, we have seen it with Saddam Hussein, we have seen it with Milosevic, we have seen it with Yanukovych, who was basically not an enemy of the West. So I think that the Kremlin is just, you know, trying to maintain peace. You know, they're trying to not to sharpen the edges. And I'm not sure this is the right attitude, because sooner or later you would have to confront them. You know, these people will not leave you in peace. They don't want peace. And when you talk about the historic precedents, I mean, it is acknowledged now that the invasion of Iraq was a mistake. Did anyone in the State Department, did anyone have to go through any suffering, any punishment because of that? No. And of course, you may understand, I think you would agree with me, that invading a country and killing 1 million people there and losing 4,000 killed American soldiers, that is obviously something more serious than talking for 5 minutes to the Russian ambassador and mentioning the word sanctions during that conversation. The people like Bob Gates, you know, who were the masterminds of the wars of the 90s, who basically indirectly participated in the killing of thousands of people. These people are now writing memoirs, and they were never thrown out of their offices like Michael Flynn was thrown out. So it just tells you that if you look for precedents, it's just useless, you know. Michael Flynn was destroyed politically and morally, not because there were some precedents in the 18th or early 19th century. He was destroyed because the ultra-liberals saw him as not completely loyal because of his visit to Moscow. It's as simple as that.
And finally, you mentioned the fact that the sanctions missed the target. Mark Sloboda, our mutual friend, has said that the biggest impact on him is that he now has to buy Parmesan cheese made in Russia instead of Italy for his pasta. One of the effects of this hostility by the United States, and particularly moving against both Russia and China at the same time, is to undo something or to provide something to the Russian government that has eluded them since Nikita Khrushchev, and that is a strategic alliance with China. Now Russia and China both declare that there is a strategic alliance, you know, between them, and as these people keep moving against one or the other, that can only solidify it.
Well, I mean, Russian-Chinese alliance is a miracle produced by Mr. Obama. I mean, it's a negative miracle for the United States, because Russia and China never thought about this kind of alliance. It would have never been possible if the foreign policy of Mr. Obama had not been so aggressive. Obama is a sort of anti-Nixon. You know, Nixon managed to have an alliance, or at least normal relations, even with the Chinese Stalin, you know, the Chairman Mao, you know. And Obama, dealing with two very docile, you know, actually pretty, I would say, pretty sound governments, both in Moscow and Beijing, managed to spoil his relations with them to the point when these two countries, you know, Russia and China, potential competitors in Asia, suddenly became allies to life and death, you know, in a matter of 2 years. So it was Obama who made this achievement. And achievement, of course, I'm being ironic, for the United States is no achievement.
Yes, we must warn people.
But Mr. Trump first tried to outdo Obama, because his idea to forge closer relations with Taiwan was just, I would say, I would give him silver for stupidity. I mean, Obama gets the gold for alienating both Moscow and Beijing. Trump gets the silver for his call, for his conversation with the Taiwanese president. So, I mean, little by little, we see this very, very sad picture. I mean, Trump is obviously incompetent, but not in the way the ultra-liberals suspected him of being incompetent. Trump just has some of the superstitions, I would say, some of the prejudices that the diehard American conservatives have. He still considers Iran as a threat, even though Iran may be a threat to Israel, but let's not forget that Israel is a much greater threat to Iran, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So Iran may be a threat to Israel, but Iran is not a threat to the United States. And if you look at the recent history, Iran did not attack anyone. Iran was the victim of attacks from Saddam Hussein, indirect attacks from the United States, terrible, terrible terrorist acts by the Sunni radicals in the Middle East, including the explosion of the Iranian embassy in Beirut. So Iran was the victim, but it never invaded other countries. It never made them live the lives that they didn't want to live. That was something Mr. Obama did and Mr. George Bush the Jr. did. So basically, unfortunately, Trump has all of these prejudices. He, if he is leaving them behind, he is doing it very slowly. He is obviously not ready to really fight the Goliath of the ultra-liberal ideology, which is extremely cruel, which already destroyed hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. I know it's an oxymoron, you know, aggressive liberalism, but, you know, aggressive or totalitarian socialism used to be an oxymoron. Unfortunately, we had to live with that oxymoron. You know, wild, barbaric nationalism used to be an oxymoron. We had to live with it when the Nazis came to power in Nazi Germany. So now we have to live with the oxymoron of aggressive ultra-liberals. And Trump seems not to understand it. He still thinks that, okay, there is bad CNN, there is bad Washington Post. He doesn't give himself, you know, the trouble to see behind, to see what is behind these CNN cameras and Washington Post editorials. There are very clear, ideological, I would say fanatical people behind them. So instead of seeing these people and declaring a moral fight against them, Trump continues to threaten Iran and to call on Russia to give Crimea back to Ukraine, even though that is simply idiotic, because we're not going to give up 2 million people to the regime which is destroying other 2 million people in the southeast of its territory, simply because these people hold 3% of the Ukrainian territory, and they want to speak Russian there, and they don't want to say that Stalin was worse than Hitler, and they don't want to have American FBI agents train them how to be good policemen. So these people, these 2 million people in Donbass, have been destroyed and starved by this regime. And Trump expects us to give Crimea to this regime with 2 more million people. That is simply stupid, you know. So unfortunately, today we had a big disappointment from Mr. Trump, and we had the terrible truth revealing itself to us, and that truth is that the ultra-liberals continue to rule the United States even after losing elections. You know, they actually don't need elections to rule. They rule via appeal courts, Circuit 9. They rule via Congress people that they control. You know, they're basically the insane people like John McCain and others. They rule via their media. They continue to be the masters of the United States, unfortunately.
Dmitry Babich, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it, even though it's after 10 o'clock in Moscow. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for calling me. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.